walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Dr. Tim Caro, professor at UC Davis and wildlife biologist whose new book is Zebra Stripes. In the book, Caro examines the purpose of zebra stripes, a debate that extends back to at least the era of Charles Darwin. And over the course of the book, he presents 18 hypotheses on the topic. One of the fascinations of zebra stripes is that Caro takes you, the reader, along as he tests these hypotheses, mostly observations done in an area of Tanzania, including fashioning models of zebras and other animals. And at one point, Caro himself dons a zebra costume. We'll discuss some of these methods, various aspects of zebra stripes, and the conclusions the book draws when I speak with Dr. Tim Caro in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Later, I'll speak briefly with Terry Pavinsky, an artist whose work is currently exhibited in a solo art show entitled Animals We Love, on view at Complete Sweet Shop in Pinellas Park. Lastly, I'm compelled practically by federal charter to mention that WNF's winter membership drive starts 1 week from today, February 8th, and I will be fundraising on Talking Animals that very day, February 8th at 10 a.m., always assigned a towering goal, but it's reached a ridiculous height. It's been increased to where I'm now supposed to raise $3,200 in less than an hour. The less said about this development, the better, except there's no way to raise that amount in 55 minutes. I'll have next Wednesday. The only prospect of succeeding is to receive some early donations, so I hope you'll consider visiting talkinganimals.net, where you'll find all kinds of information about fast, easy ways to donate and details about our exclusive thank you gifts for certain donations, including amazing tickets to catch Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers on their 40th anniversary tour, a special pair of tickets to see Chris Rock on his first stand-up tour in 9 years, and a discounted week-long stay in a condo on the Hawaiian island of Kauai. Again, talkinganimals.net for all that information and more. Right now, let's get to Dr. Caro and zebras with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Dr. Tim Caro to Talking Animals. Good morning, Dr. Caro.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. I guess the monumental question before we proceed any further for you, is it zebra or zebra?
Doesn't really matter. It just depends where you come from.
So okay.
I switch between the two.
Okay, good. All right. So it's okay if I say zebra just because that's where I come from.
Go for it.
All right, great. So before we actually get into zebra stripes, both the topic and the book, I'd like to find out a little bit more about you before you reach the zebra stripe stage. For example, if we trace the arc of your academic career backwards a bit, to what extent is studying animals a through line?
Well, I was trained as a zoologist when I went to university, especially in animal behavior. And then when I came to the States, I started to teach courses on conservation biology, but maintained my interest in animal behavior. But then about 20 years ago, in 1996, I started to work on coloration in mammals. And since that time, that's really grown and grown. And now I'm fully involved in trying to find out why various species of mammals are colored the way they are. And the reason that I'm interested in that is because when we're kids, we're told that zebras or zebras are black and white with stripes, or pandas are black and white, or giraffe have mottled coloration, but we're never told why they have those kind of colors. And so when a child asks its parents, well, okay, I know what a zebra looks like, but why dad or why mom? They always say, well, I don't really know, but I suspect it's whatever it is. A bit unsatisfactory.
Well, yeah, and even worse, sometimes for dimwits in a bar or somewhere, the zebra question has tended to kind of bottom out at, is a zebra a black horse with white stripes or a white horse with black stripes? So we've come a long way from there, certainly in your book.
Yeah, it's certainly a black animal in utero. So the foals, as they're developing in their mother's womb, are black, and then the white stripes develop after that. So there's really no question about that.
Yeah.
Barroom talk.
Okay, good. Well, we've settled one thing right off the bat. Thank God. So just to back up for one sec, how did you, after kind of a long, it sounds like career in other areas, how did you get interested in animal coloration? What spawned that interest?
Well, what's happened is that in the last 20 years, we've suddenly got new methods of being able to understand animal coloration. In particular, we can measure colors objectively. So before that, really in the 1980s, 1970s, we were simply seeing color through human eyes. And so we were unable to really see how other animals see colors in nature. So that was a major breakthrough. And I think that it's sort of unfair to think about humans as being the right animal to view color, because we're a primate, and primates are particularly good at seeing colors and seeing three colors, red, green, and blue, whereas most of the animals, like your normal cat or dog, can only really see in two colors, a kind of red-green color blindness. And so that's made us reassess what the colors that nature provides.
Because it sounds like our situation in seeing colors is not really representative of what does go on in the animal world.
No, that's right. And there's a number of bird species, probably about half of them, can also see in ultraviolet light. And so they can see in four colors, and we can't get anywhere close to think to understand what that might be. So all different species, some of the nocturnal species, can only see in one color. And so that was a real breakthrough, is the best word, in thinking about how we need to understand coloration in nature.
And more to the point, I guess, why animals are colored the way they are, what evolutionary or other sort of purpose there is behind that animal looking that way or being colored that way.
Yeah, it's going to be an evolutionary question. So if we see an animal that has got red or green feathers, we can ask the question, why might that be? Is that because it wants to be camouflaged against a green background, or because it wants to show off to females during the mating season? So one can always ask why questions about animal behavior or animal structure.
Well, the central question, having dispensed with the low-level bar question quite readily, the central question of your book, though, is why do zebras have stripes? I mean, in reading the book, I mean, one of the fascinations of it I found is that you really take the reader along on testing out, laying out these hypotheses as to why the zebras would have stripes, and then testing them so that even if you're not much of a scientist, which I certainly would apply to myself, I mean, you really have like sort of a front row seat in the methods that you are using to run through these hypotheses. And some, what sounds like maybe people listening, like a very sort of maybe even oddly specific question, is really fascinating in the way that you answer it and seek to answer it over the course of the book.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, given you've got a lot of hypotheses, there are sort of about eight major ones that can be divided up into sort of sub-hypotheses. And as you say, there are nearly 20 of these. Every summer, after I'd finished teaching at UC Davis, I would then go out with some equipment or certainly some new ideas and try and test another hypothesis. And inevitably, I would come back when the quarter started in late September, rather depressed, because I would have tested something fairly thoroughly and come back with the answer is, no, it's not that. And so, in a sense, the book was a period of self-discovery for me over a 10-year period. I was just chipping away at each of these different hypotheses. But the strength of that, I think, is that it's as important in science to understand what's not correct as what is correct. And so you're always going to get people say, well, have you thought of that? And then if the answer is, well, yes, actually, I have thought of that, and that doesn't work, then you make an argument a lot more robust.
Again, it just in reading the book, as a non-scientist, but still at least on a surface level familiar with like the scientific method and stuff, it seems like that's exactly what is happening in the book. You're saying, all right, this is one hypothesis, I guess, as it turns out now, over that summer, let's test it out. Oops, I'm glad we tested it, but that's not the answer. I guess we'll come back next summer for more exploration and answers.
Yeah, that's correct. And the difficulty was trying to come up with tests of hypotheses that weren't very well formulated. So, for example, somebody has suggested that stripes would facilitate a grooming between individual zebras. And so to try and think, how might I test that in the field, proved to be very difficult. So it's certainly an idea that I thought was weak. But it's no point in just sitting in an armchair and saying, well, I'm sure that hypothesis doesn't work. You have to go out and look at it. And the way that one tackles that kind of question is you compare grooming rates in striped and non-striped equids, or the horse other members of the horse family that are not striped, and then you'd expect to see a lot more grooming in the striped species than the unstriped species, and that isn't the case. But it's difficult to think of ways of testing many of these ideas.
Well, I'm sure probably many folks, for example, might have pondered at least that zebra stripes are there to confuse or neutralize predators like lions and hyenas. But maybe you could talk about that. It doesn't necessarily apparently hold up either.
Yeah, the two ideas that the public have about this particular pattern of external coloration, these contrasting black and white stripes, are either that it's camouflage or that it's confusing predators. And right from the get-go, camouflage seems very unlikely because there are so few other species of mammals that have this kind of coloration. But there are many, many species of mammals that have just either brown or gray coats to match their background, or else if they are striped, they're very subtle, mottled striping that's often difficult to see in grassland, and zebras don't really live in tall grasslands anyway. So that seemed like an unlikely idea, which I was able to test using people to see how quickly models of zebras and unstriped horses disappeared at dusk or appeared in the morning. And in addition, the other popular idea is that somehow zebras running off in all directions, or perhaps in a group of animals, confuse the predator and stop it being able to catch prey. And again, that right from the get-go, that seems unlikely, because certainly lions are very, very good at catching zebras. And so you'd have to have sort of special pleading to make that argument work.
And even just the idea about the sort of camouflage thing, I mean, I think to a lot of people, and again, it's ultimately, I guess, one of those that was disproven over the course of your work, but I mean, it is initially counterintuitive when you either see pictures of zebras, or if you've been lucky enough, as I have, to actually see them in the wild. I mean, there are circumstances, as you say, at dusk or other times, where an animal that seems so striking and vibrant, like how could this ever disappear or fade into the background, does.
Well, that's correct, but you don't need stripes to do that. So I think one of the important points to come out of this book is that we were able to model how a spotted hyena or a lion, which are the main predators of zebras in Africa, how they actually see stripes. And going back to what we were talking about earlier, humans have much, much better visual systems than those carnivores. And once we'd done the modeling by knowing how many rods and cones in the eye and how big the eyes are and making some assumptions, we realized that really these stripes were only going to be visible very, very close up to the animals, especially at night or at dusk and dawn when they hunt. And so it's probable that the stripes only appear as stripes to lions and hyenas when the zebra is so close that they can either hear the animal or smell the animal already. And so if that's the case, then the idea that stripes are in some way making the animal camouflaged just doesn't really hold. So all animals kind of fade into the background, whatever kind of color they are, at some distance. That'll be the same for carnivores and humans. But close up, we can see the stripes, but their main predators simply can't see those stripes. And so then you say, well, stripes cannot really be anything to do with signaling to lions or hyenas.
So again, that's one of those things where you had to, as part of the process, make the allowance for the superior human vision, or at least distinction of colors, over a lot of the animals, perhaps including the lion and the hyena.
Yes, that's right. And all these hypotheses to do with predation, that will be camouflage so that you are not seen by predators, or confusion so you stop predators being successful in their attacks, really don't hold water, because if you look across many, many studies of lions on the African continent, you find that the preferred prey of lions are zebras. So they actually go out of their way to attack and kill zebras. They're really one of the staple diet. And so it's so unlikely that you can really push this argument for an anti-predation hypothesis very much further.
Let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Dr. Tim Kara, whose new book is Zebra Stripes, A Thorough Examination of Why Exactly Zebras Have Stripes. If you'd like to ask Dr. Kara a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. Over the course of the book, and as you're exploring other hypotheses, you see how sometimes this sort of research can also require carpentry skills, which I didn't necessarily expect. So one part of the research on the purpose of zebra stripes is that you build, and your colleagues build, models of zebras and other animals. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that and what that was seeking to explore.
Yeah, we had to build life-size models of equids, that's members of the horse family, and then we would paint them different colors, so like a zebra or a brown animal or a gray animal, and then we would set them out against a wooded background or a grassland background, and then the teams of us would, every 5 minutes, record whether we could still see the animal or not see it as dusk approached. And so that gives you an idea of how conspicuous or how camouflaged the zebra is compared to a control in the experiment. And time again, everybody could see the zebra much, much longer than the other animals. And so carpentry skills were involved. There was also, when I came to test the biting fly hypothesis, that's the idea that stripes are in some way a defense against biting flies, because biting flies don't like to land on black and white stripes. Then I would have to resort in some of the experiments to either wearing a suit made of black and white stripes, or else walking in a zebra pelt through areas with a lot of tsetse flies or turbaned biting flies like horse flies and deer flies, in order to see whether I was being attacked more by the flies when I wore a zebra coat than when I wore a black coat or a gray coat or a white coat. And so you have to sort of think a little bit outside the box to be able to test some of these ideas.
I was struck by not only thinking outside the box, but your thorough dedication to this research when you're donning a zebra suit. And I guess also at that part, I was wondering, the very purpose of that is to really evaluate what happens with tsetse flies, horse flies, etc. First of all, what kind of risk, if any, were you at for being bitten by one or more of those flies?
Oh, I was bitten many, many times by those flies.
Okay.
So what, in the pursuit of science, that's far more exciting.
Okay. Again, hats off to your dedication. The other question is that depending on where you were doing this, and this may have been explained and I maybe read past it or whatever, at what risk were you for other animals kind of appearing on the scene and a potential sort of ugly encounter?
Well, I was working in and next to a national park where lions were, and so possibly not the most sensible thing to be walking some distance from the car dressed in a zebra pelt in a place where lions have just been walking the night before. But this was only one minor part of a long study, and so it wasn't particularly dangerous in the grand scheme of things. But I was really keen on pursuing this idea of seeing whether zebra pelts have an aversive effect against biting flies, because that's certainly been shown in the laboratory. So if you put black and white striped targets out and then watch sticky targets so that the flies land on them and then get caught, there's really good evidence to show that they don't like to land on black and white striped surfaces, and we don't understand that reason. We don't know what is special about black and white that stops horseflies and deer flies landing on those surfaces. But at the end of the day, I'm convinced that that is the reason that zebras have black and white stripes. It's to avoid the attention of biting flies.
Right. So in a way, I guess we should say this is something of a spoiler alert, but ultimately, after testing those 18 hypotheses, that seemed to be the reason that emerged that would explain the stripes.
Yes, it is. And we did. I'm convinced of that in two ways. One is that we constructed some of these deer and horsefly traps and wrapped one in a zebra pelt and one in a wildebeest pelt, and certainly the zebra pelt attracts far fewer of these flies. But in addition, there was work that we did back in the library here at the University at Davis, and where we pitted all the different hypotheses against each other and set them out on a map of the world. So we saw where lions lived, where there are a lot of trees because of camouflaged against woodlands, different temperature isoclines to test ideas about temperature regulation. And then we overlaid where all the horse subspecies are found, some of which are heavily striped, some of which are lightly striped. And you quickly see that there's an increased intensity of striping where these biting flies, particularly horse and deer flies, but also tsetse flies, are found. And so none of the other hypotheses really match up geographically. So you don't find more lions necessarily where there's more striping across this group of horses.
One of the things that's really striking kind of about the book and the research is that there's some very low-level building models or getting in a zebra suit and kind of about as low-tech as you can get in some respects. And yet what happened with those findings to compare those hypotheses and the results of your work was obviously far more sophisticated and assisted by technology in a great way.
Well, I think the only time I really used high-tech equipment was using a thermo camera, which is a camera that takes the temperature of animals at some distance. It's like a photographic camera, except it's recording heat rather than light.
Yeah.
And that is an expensive piece of equipment. But otherwise, you're absolutely right. It's just a matter of constructing traps out of local materials, mosquito netting, that kind of thing, or building models. And obviously, I had to have a car. That was about it.
Well, and also, as you've already kind of made clear a few times, incredible focus and determination. Like, hey, tsetse flies biting me, bring it on. Chance that a lion may appear, and while I'm in my zebra suit, I don't care. I'm in search of some information here, and you're not going to stop me. That sort of focus and drive, I think, probably should be notable to any budding scientist or current scientist.
Well, thank you.
So let's take a call. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Tim Carroll.
Hi, my name's Denise from St. Pete.
Hi.
And I'm enjoying the show. It's really neat information. But I want to know what the point of his research is. Are they trying to accomplish some kind of medical or ecological information to benefit the world?
Thanks, Denise. There are two answers to that. Firstly, we're just trying to do research for understanding how nature works, so there'll be no applied spin-off at one level. But at another level, I think that it's really helpful for children in particular to know why these charismatic, familiar animals are colored in the way that they are.
Because I see.
It can turn them on to becoming more interested in nature.
And, okay.
And currently there's a real trend in this country and in Australia and New Zealand for children not to be so interested in nature. They don't like going for walks on Sunday afternoons. They don't like going to national parks as much as they used to.
Mm-hmm.
And in part, I suspect this is to do with the internet and playing on your phone rather than actually getting outside.
Yeah.
And so if we have stories like this, I think we can attract children more to the environment.
And possibly are you looking more like in the line of autistic children?
I hadn't thought of that, but that's certainly a great idea.
Yeah, because
Thank
there's
you.
A lot of information that autistic children can relate to animals and you know, that will bring them out of their shell. Okay, I just wanted to know, you know, that what your aim was.
Well, thank you. And that's that idea about autistic children is something that hadn't occurred to me, so I appreciate that.
Thank you very much, Denise. Appreciate your call.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Carroll, sort of playing off a little bit of Denise's question, do you feel like by the time you finished everything and wrote the book that you answered definitively a question that's really sort of been a longstanding question, and as I think I mentioned earlier, going back to at least Darwin and maybe well before that, that this is now kind of resolved scientifically?
Well, I think it is in a sense, in that we've answered this simple question, but every time you answer a question in science, you raise new questions. And so, as I mentioned earlier on, we still don't understand why black and white stripes are so difficult for biting flies to either see or to land on. And secondly, we don't understand why horses in particular are so vulnerable to biting fly attack. And we suspect that it's the diseases that they carry in Africa. They carry four fatal diseases to horses and zebras in Africa. And so that has kind of opened up new questions about what are these diseases and what are the visual mechanisms of these flies. But in terms of have we solved the problem, yes, we have solved the problem. And going back to Denise's question, I'm actually writing a children's book now with my son, who's an artist, about why zebras are black and white, so we can reach a much larger audience than we can with this adult book.
Oh, that's great. And from what you're saying about now, the question, as you said, often in science, a question that you answer then leads to one or more other questions that need to be answered. Do you see yourself pursuing research about why the stripes affect the flies the way they do in a more expansive way?
Yes, I'm actually working on a horse farm in Britain where there are tame zebras, and so I'm starting to look and actually can touch these animals because they're so tame, and we're actually starting to do some work on how biting flies attack these animals so we can get right up close to them. So yeah, I certainly haven't finished with this research, and it's a fascinating topic.
Yeah. Again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Dr. Tim Carroll, professor of wildlife biology at UC Davis, whose new book is Zebra Stripes, which, as we've covered here, really examines the question of why exactly zebras have stripes and answers that question, no less. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. On a sort of tangential note, Dr. Carroll, I mentioned on Facebook that I'd be speaking to you and put up an image or two. And one Facebook commenter noted he learned how, quote unquote, badass zebras are on a PBS special that he had seen. And I'm not sure if badass is actually the scientific term, but I've long heard how kind of mean, maybe aggressive zebras tend to be. How does this square with your years working with them?
Well, I think that all equids, all the members of the horse family, that's the asses and the Perswalski's horse that used to live in Mongolia, and also the three species of zebras, are certainly animals that you wouldn't want to encounter in a difficult situation, because they have very strong jaws and long incisor teeth, and they can certainly kick. And I think most children are told not to walk around the back of horses in case they get kicked, domestic horses. And they're also told that if you're going to feed a horse an apple, you have to hold your fingers out straight in a palm of your hand, otherwise you can lose a finger. So, and those are tame animals. So if you're dealing with an animal that's fearful of you, you do indeed have to be careful. But I'm not sure that they're particularly worse than, say, a horned herbivore like an impala or a wildebeest that has these weapons on the top of its head. But I think most of these wild animals is not something that you particularly want to fool around with.
Yeah, it'd be interesting that the place that you mentioned that has that sort of collection of zebras, I wonder what their experience there is, if they're still, even in a captive setting, the kind of biting and other stuff that you hear about or read about otherwise happens, to what degree?
Well, I think once you give once you have wild animals that are brought into captivity and then they give birth in captivity, the next generation are very easy to tame down. So it's not as if they're always going to maintain a difficult disposition.
So those could just be one generation badass, referring back to our Facebook friend here.
I think possibly.
Yeah, I got you. Now, speaking of giving birth, one of our emailers that came in a while ago, and I wanted to get to it, says, very interesting show, have always been fascinated by zebras. How good are zebras at protecting their young from predators? They seem so vulnerable.
Well, I think that most of the way that zebras live is you normally have one male and a harem of about six females. And if they're attacked by a predator or a predator appears, all the females will back off, and the male will sometimes stand his ground. And if it's a hyena, he may chase and try and kick the hyena. If any of the mares have foals, they will go right to the back of the group and effectively try to keep the foals behind them so that they are either not seen by the predator or else they're very far away.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there's anything particularly striking about the way that these animals try to protect members of the group. And certainly females don't try and look out for each other in the harem. It's only the male who will put up any sort of defense.
I see. Okay, let's take another call. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Tim Carroll.
Hey, great Saturday. Dr. Tim, I had a question about zebras and was always curious about it. And that question is, over the thousands of years, how come they were never domesticated?
Can you just repeat that question?
Yeah, sorry. He says, over the thousands of years, how come they were never domesticated?
Thank you. I'll listen on the radio.
Thank you.
That's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that. So, I'm not sure that I can answer that with any authority. I know that during the First World War, there was some attempt to try to bring zebras into the military by the British and the Germans who were fighting in East Africa. But that failed. I think the war fizzled out before they really got that going. But certainly, there were zebras that were brought over to London Zoo, for example, in the 1880s, that were used to pull carriages of Victorians around the zoo in London. And so there was some domestication going on, but never really full scale. Perhaps we've already domesticated horses, and so we didn't need to domesticate zebras as well.
Okay. Well, Dr. Carroll, out of two callers, two have suggested lines of, if not research, Denise with the raising the notion about autistic kids on the autistic spectrum and related to your findings, and now, as it turns out, the children's book you and your son are writing, and then we have the question, the ongoing question of about zebras being domesticated. So we're just in the last minute or two here, Dr. Carroll, but what research is immediately next, or are you already in the midst of?
Well, I've just completed a study that's in press on looking at why giant pandas have black and white coloration. And it sounds like an easy question, but it's taken us over 2 years to get to the answer. And again, I've been pursuing that question because I'm interested in trying to get kids involved in thinking more about the natural world. I'm not going to give the answer to that question here because I'm not allowed to. It's under embargo. But I'm still interested in looking at coloration of particular mammals because most mammals are pretty boring browns and grays, like think about mice. And so once you get a species that's really oddly colored, that poses an interesting question for evolutionary biologists.
And it does seem like you're perhaps becoming the black and white coloration specialist.
We'll see.
Yeah, great. All right, well, Dr. Carroll, I appreciate your time. We've been speaking to Dr. Tim Carroll. His new book is Zebra Stripes. He, again, is a professor at UC Davis, wildlife biologist, and we'll look forward to, when it's out of embargo, the answer about the giant panda question about black and white. So, Dr. Carroll, thank you so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you, Duncan.
In a few moments, I'll speak briefly with artist Terry Pavinsky about his current art show in Pinellas Park called Animals We Love. Right now, it's time to step into the comedy corner with a favorite piece from a Talking Animals favorite. This is Brian Regan with a piece called Whale Noises in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals.
I saw this documentary recently on whales. This guy has dedicated his life to telling you what the whales are saying. Wow. I don't know how you'd argue with him when he turns in his report. And he just throws it down there. Well, here's what the whales are saying. Okay, thanks, Charlie. He's looking back. Here's what the whales are saying. Yeah, Charlie figured it out. They show how he does it. He's out on a ship. He's got a pencil, and he deciphers the whale noises as he hears them. You know, he'll hear like... You know, he's like, oh, okay. Oh, he's lonely. No, you're lonely. How'd you like to do that for like 2 weeks and then turn around and find out that the door's squeaking behind you?
That was Brian Regan with a piece called Whale Noises, taken from his album simply entitled Live. Now on to my conversation with Terry Pavinsky about his solo art show, Animals We Love. Let's welcome Terry Pavinsky to Talking Animals. Good morning, Terry.
Hi, Duncan. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals. And so let's jump right in. I mean, people who may have been on Facebook earlier might have seen a post by you and or me with some samples of your work. But let's talk a little bit about what method or methods that you use in making your art.
Okay. Came down to Florida in 59. I was 9, went through the school system, taught elementary ed at Bowder Elementary. But in the 70s, I got interested in art and went back at night to get my art degree, thinking I might move into high school. But the junior college started a really neat program in the summer for kids, art and music classes. So I was able to do that for 20 years. And lately, in the 80s, I got involved with Mainsail, led the Vanguard category, dealing with environmental kinds of things, giant kaleidoscopes and solar-powered bubble machines. But most recently, I do some laser light pieces at the Art Pool Gallery, and John Gascott, the local artist, hooks me up with some just small restaurants to show some of my work. But basically, I'm a Warhol primary color devotee, and I hand paint everything. I either start with black and white, or I reduce it to black and white, and just use primary colors. And anything else that happens secondarily is just sort of random or accidental on purpose. And so I usually just do a few pieces a month with John, different theme shows at Pom Poms and Cider Press. But he approached me about this Pinellas Arts Village, which I was really unaware of, and that's where the show is now. I can tell you more about that later. But
sure.
Basically, I just hand paint black and white, and no computer work, any of that stuff. Just an old dinosaur.
Okay. Well, that's our favorite kind of dinosaur.
Yeah. So more than you wanted to know. Sorry.
No. That's great. And then Terry, for the purpose of both this show and your exhibit currently,
right.
why animals? Are you a longtime animal guy?
Yeah, I've been a vegetarian or vegan since 75, and probably my closest relationships have been with animals. My ex-girlfriend used to accuse me of loving my little Lindy dog, the Yorkie Poo, more than her, and she was probably pretty close to her.
Okay.
But anyway, I just love animals, and I care for them. And I just was approached about doing this solo show, and it was probably a little more than I'm used to doing, but I thought, well, if I could turn it into something, it would be beneficial. So I had a lot of animal pictures in my files and whatever, and I worked up some new ones, you know, some animal friends in the neighborhood and some iconic figures like Cecil the lion, that sort of thing.
Sure. And how long have you incorporated animals into your art?
Oh, probably off and on over the years.
Yeah.
You know, John Gascott had a pom-pom show recently that was related to animals also, so I was kind of, you know, revisiting them.
Right, I gotcha. As you noted, kind of influenced by Warhol, there's really a lot of sort of bright primary colors in your work. Anything in particular driving that, or?
Well, just my 60s influence, the Warhol, and I've gotten to know Peter Max very well over the years when he comes to town. In fact, he's coming to Sit and Tell Galleries February 25th, and I just love the funness of it, you know, the colors and how they accidentally, combine and keep things as random as possible, try not to have too much control over it.
So tell us a little bit about the show itself, where folks can see this collection of animal art.
I just went there the first time recently. It's Pinellas Arts Village, and it's really neat. The city is constructing or creating these just neat complexes and then leasing them to artists, I guess, affordably. Derek Donnelly, you know, the big mural artist in town, has this residence and studio there in the village. John Gascott is with several artists that are leasing spaces from the city in this big complex. So it's all part of Arts Village, and they have their art walk every fourth Saturday, and there's like several businesses just all close together there that cooperate and participate.
Cool.
And right now, the sweet shop, it's really cool. These sisters, they're so sweet. They make all their own pastries and whatever. So Saturday night at the show, there was definitely a flow of people in and out of there. And it's just a small little venue. The sweet shop's probably one-third of the whole complex there. But it's just a nice little neat little small venue. And I was able to, I've got 15, 11 by 14 prints, and then I've got some T-shirts available, too.
The sweet shop, Complete Sweet Shop is, I guess, the name. That's where your pieces are actually
displayed. Yeah, 5721 75th. It's part of that village, but that's its specific address.
Great. And so I guess the other thing is we should notice that the exhibit runs through February 18th, so
yes,
people still have more than a couple weeks to get over there and check it out. And then if people are inclined to buy something, we can't really get into the prices on the air, but if they are, I understand you have decided to earmark some donations.
Yeah, that was another motivating factor to go ahead and do a bigger show and farther away or whatever, that could split up the profits. They're reasonably priced anyway, but split up the profits with, you know, originally I just thought generally the ASPCA, but I guess I should maybe focus more locally, like the Humane Society of Pinellas, but somebody worthwhile will definitely get any half the proceeds.
That's great. All right, well, Terry, well, good luck, and again, I'm glad we've still got a nice hunk of time for people to get out and check out your work, and it sounds like, just from what you're saying, just the overall area there is terrific.
Yeah, it's really growing. I was really surprised.
Great. All right, well, good luck, and thanks for representing our animal friends in cool and interesting ways.
You're welcome. Thank you, Duncan, for all that you do, too.
Absolutely. Thanks. Bye-bye. Again. Take care. All right, coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity. Rolling into the noon hour, concerts, a full 2 hours of interviews, phone calls, news, and more. With contributions from members of the stellar WNF staff, including, of course, Everyday Ethics with Craig Kopp. Meanwhile, as a prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a Talking Animals t-shirt. Right now, it's time for some animal news and announcement. Pup Crawl Alert, coming up in about 10 days, February 11th. And downtown St. Pete, Pet Pal Animal Shelter is putting on its third annual Pup Crawl, which, of course, is a dog-friendly fundraiser for Pet Pal. And there'll be all kinds of cool things happening, and you can make it from one bar to the next with your pup in tow. And you can find out more about that by going to petpalanimalshelter.com. And a few interesting things have popped up in the news, notwithstanding what might be happening or has been happening lately in Washington, D.C., but apropos sort of our panel discussion last week about Ringling Brothers, there was a piece in the New York Times, I think it was yesterday or the day before, by a guy sort of reminiscing fondly about Ringling Brothers, so that's one take as part of what was represented in that conversation last week as well. And also, I was really sad, of course, as many people were, to see Mary Tyler Moore pass away. One thing that's been really, really nice has been, of course, been an amazing array of salutes and tributes and all kinds of people who are just greatly influenced by Mary Tyler Moore one way or another. But one thing you may want to track down if you haven't already seen it is Gene Bauer, the co-founder of Farm Animal Sanctuary, wrote a beautiful piece about Mary Tyler Moore, focusing in this case on her longstanding love of and work on behalf of animals, and recount some anecdotes of working with her to shoot like a little video, and so he was in the unlikely position of directing Mary Tyler Moore, but he's very sweet about it, and the piece is great. So that was in the New York Daily News, I think, officially yesterday, so you might want to check that out as well. All right, I think that's going to do it for today's edition of Animal News and Announcements. Amy Mann has a new record out. Well, it's coming out. The album itself is called Mental Illness, but there already one song has been released as kind of a sneak preview, and arguably, and that's all I really need to play any minute, arguably it's an animal song of sorts. It's called Goose Snow Cone, new music from Amy Mann on Talking Animals.
Looking into the face of the goose snow cone. Should be shaking it loose, but you do it alone. Every look is a truce, and it's written in stone. Keep it together when your friends come back. Always checking the weather, but they wanna know why. Even birds of a feather find it hard to fly. Thought I saw at my feet an origami crow. Snatching defeat, it's the devil I know. Gotta keep it together when your friends come back.
Music from Amy Mann, Goose Snow Cone, from a forthcoming album, Mental Illness. I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. This is a giveaway, but please only participate. If you haven't won something from WNF in the last 90 days, there'll be a prize, a Talking Animals t-shirt, to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals.
Dog goes bow out, kitty goes meow, the milk cow, she goes moo. Chicken goes clucking, the duck goes quack, and the rooster goes cock-a-doodle-doo. The pig is fat and the snail is slow, and the donkey sure is dumb. The lion is brave and the bear is strong, and the snake spits out its tongue.
All right, if you're able to name that animal tune, we will probably take it off the air, because we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Laura is up next, but amounts to 2 hours of radioactivity. I'll be back next Wednesday, February 8th, alongside my friend Laura Taylor, asking for your support. Talking Animals and WMNF. But again, if there's any way you could donate early, how about today? I'd graciously appreciate it. Please go to talkinganimals.net for all details about fast, easy ways you can donate today and cool, exclusive ways we have to thank you. You'll also see audio archives there of every show we've ever broadcast, iTunes podcast as well, links to Talking Animals Facebook page, Twitter feed, and more. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. Homegrown, handpicked music and news. We'll see you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Please help us on our fun drive. Thanks.